Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1983, and the presenter was Roy Plumley.
As usual, the castaway is introduced by Roy Plumley.
On our desert island this week is the composer Peter Maxwell Davies. Max, you have 8 discs. Would you prefer scores?
I probably would prefer scores, because then you can make your own interpretation in your own mind. Not that it would be any better than the ones on the record, but at least it would change, and records don't, you know.
No, they don't, and records is what you've got. Now, in real life, you've chosen to live on a small island, so you quite enjoy solitude.
Very much so, yes. I think it's important for a composer not only to be with people, working with musicians and knowing how audiences react and what the professional side of communicating music is all about, but also to be by himself so that he comes to terms with the compositional problems that he has in his own time and to the fullest possible extent. And that's my reason for, in fact, going to an island, but not a desert one.
Right. In choosing your 8 records, what were you looking for? Did you have a plan?
Not really. I didn't have a plan when I thought about this, but I didn't choose my favourite pieces in a way, in the way that most people, I think, do, because as a composer, as a musician, you carry around in your head an enormous number of scores. And I think a lot of the pieces which most people might think I would choose, like the Beethoven symphonies or quartets or the Mozart operas or things which are standard, well, you know those so well,
yes,
that you can more or less just play them through in your mind and go from the beginning to the end.
Yeah.
I think that one wants to find something which perhaps one doesn't know quite so well and which is going to be very stimulating.
Where do we start? What's your first one?
Well, the first one is by Beethoven, in fact. It's the Great Fugue from the late B-flat quartet.
Why do you choose this one?
Well, this piece intrigues me, because Beethoven finished this quartet with this fugue and then withdrew it and put a very conventional little finale on instead of this fugue. And I wonder why there was this crisis of self-confidence, because this fugue is, I think, one of the most outrageously original movements that Beethoven ever wrote. And at the height of his powers, he withdrew it. And I wonder whether this was to do with his health, his deafness, the fact that his nephew had tried to commit suicide because of Beethoven's dreadful behaviour towards him, which must have worried even Beethoven quite dreadfully and attacked his self-confidence. But there's a problem here. Quite apart from the intrinsic problem of Beethoven making a fugue as an integral form of a whole movement rather than a passing reference in a movement, which I think poses problems for him. But there's also this very interesting problem for me as a composer of why he actually rejected this music.
Beethoven's Grosse Fuge, Opus 133, played by the Lindsay String Quartet. Max, where were you born?
I was born in Manchester.
One of a large family?
No, I was the only one.
Was there a lot of music in your home?
No, there wasn't. My parents were very interested in musical comedy and light music, but there wasn't very much interest in serious music. This was something I found myself. And
do you remember your very first exposure to music, the first time?
Yes. First time it really hit me was when I was taken to see the Gondoliers.
Mm-hmm.
And I determined there and then that that was what my life was about. It was just one of those extraordinary experiences. I was four.
Was it a doily cart production?
No, it wasn't. It was at Salford Central Mission, a local Methodist group, amateur production, but I thought it was wonderful, and I can still remember it with tremendous affection and detail.
Was there a piano in the house?
There was eventually. We got my grandmother's piano, and I was sent off for piano lessons to Miss Jones in Swinton, Manchester, where we lived, and very quickly I became interested in the Beethoven piano sonatas and the Mozart piano sonatas and this, that and the other. And this was very largely due to being able to borrow these things from the public library in Manchester. And my gratitude for that will always be infinite.
You began to explore the repertoire.
Yes, quite a lot of things were just not available on record then, of course, particularly the new scores, which I was interested in by Messiaen, Stravinsky, so on. And one just had to try to come to terms with these at the piano. And I think it's a very good thing to have to do that. You really do learn how to read a full score at the piano.
Mm.
And I found that I was borrowing probably half a dozen scores every week and thundering through them at the piano, probably very badly. But at least I got to know them, and this was awfully important.
How much music was there at your school?
That's a good question. There was very little indeed. It was a rather sorry experience at Lee Grammar School in those days.
There's a sad story you have of the day when you asked if you could take an O-level in music.
Yes, and the headmaster refused. He said, "My dear boy, this is not a girls' school."
Oh, dear, that's a terrible story. Let's have your second record.
This is something which I was very fond of when I was at Lee Grammar School. It's L'Enfant et le Sortilège, Child and the Witchcraft, I suppose you could call it, by Ravel. And the bit that I'd like to hear is where suddenly you're transported into the garden at night. And I think it's one of those most marvellous, economic but atmospheric pieces of painting in music that I know.
An excerpt from Ravel's L'Enfant et les Sortilèges, a performance by the French National Radio Orchestra and Chorus conducted by Ernest Bourg. So you were working away on your own, Max. Who was encouraging you?
Well, I don't really know. I think I was doing it on my own with my parents' backing. My piano teacher didn't really approve of what I was doing because I was starting to write music which had dire influences like Stravinsky and so on, which were completely beyond her ken. And it was a very, very lonely road that I was going along in those days.
You were a very imaginative lad. You invented a language of your own, didn't you?
Oh, I did all sorts of silly things like that, yes. I think the normal sort of things that imaginative children do. We were learning German and Latin and French at school, and of course you could turn those backwards and put the endings of one set of cases onto the other language and invent a script for it. The kind of thing that one tends to do sometimes in one's composition of music.
Were you bright in other subjects?
I think I was fairly bright, yes.
What about other school activities like sport and so on?
sport bored me out of my mind. It was not that I was a weakling or anything at all. Never have been. But just the whole point of it just escaped me. And I remember being in trouble for daydreaming on the cricket field. I was even writing music while I was supposed to be fielding, I remember. I found the whole thing so tedious.
You were obviously hoping for a career in music. How did you visualise yourself? Conducting a prom as a soloist, as a composer? What was your impact on music to be?
I knew that I was going to be a composer. That was all that I really was interested in. Not so much playing or conducting, but just composing. Mm-hmm. And I was very interested in opera and the theatre, and I saw myself doing something on those lines, writing music, possibly incidental music for film. I had no highfalutin ideas about being a big-name composer, but I thought I might be able to make an honest living, perhaps writing incidental music or something of that kind.
You moved on to Manchester University as a music scholar.
Yes, yes.
And then to the Royal Manchester School of Music, or was that at the same time?
At the same time, yes.
Which contemporaries of yours would we know by name?
Well, at the Royal Manchester College of Music, now the Northern College, of course, there was a whole group of people who banded together just for survival, I think, because it was a pretty dire institution in those days with very little encouragement for any interest in new music. And we called ourselves New Music Manchester. There were Harrison Birtwistle, Alexander Gurr,
yes.
Elgar Howarth, John Ogden, Rodney Friend, I remember, who's now leading the BBC Symphony Orchestra. He played some of my music then. It was a very, I think, a very good group of students in that we were always discussing. I remember we spent whole nights just talking around a table at Alexander Gurr's flat. And that talk, I think, was something which I will never, ever forget. It was just, he's absolutely brilliant, and he was really the leader of that group. And he was one's contact with, well, his father's teacher, Schoenberg, for instance, who was a tremendous influence on me then.
As a student, did you work during the vacations in a musical line in tea shops or anything like that? Keep going.
No, I worked as a postman, I remember.
A very unmusical occupation on the whole. Although you could hum and whistle as you went round.
Yes, you were free to think your thoughts.
Now, you were writing and obviously rejecting your first works. What was the first work to which you wanted to put your name, Opus 1?
Opus 1 was a piece I wrote for Elgar Howarth, who now, of course, is a conductor, but then was a trumpet player. And he and I, and eventually he and John Ogden, played this trumpet sonata that I wrote, and that is my Opus 1. I got as far as Opus 2, and then I forgot about Opus numbers. I thought they were too pretentious. But this piece, I remember, I wrote this for Elgar Howarth and sent it off to the Society for the Promotion of New Music, and they sent it back, saying it was impossible to play for both the pianist and the trumpeter. Well, we'd given performances of it in Manchester, so the whole lot of us just went down to London, put on our own concert, and jolly well showed them.
I hope they were duly humiliated.
Well, I doubt it.
Your second record, what's that? No, I beg your pardon, your third record.
Third record, well, I mentioned Schoenberg, who I think is one of the most underplayed but one of the most influential composers of the century, and certainly when I was a student, just by looking at the score, one couldn't listen to it then, there was no record, I was very influenced by these early five orchestral pieces of his, and this one, Colours, or Summer Morning by a Lake, its other title, I still find quite atmospheric, and it leads me to think about all sorts of marvellous orchestral colours in my own work.
one of Schoenberg's five orchestral pieces, Colours or Early Morning by a Lake, played by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Pierre Boulez. You went off to study in Rome. How did that come about?
I got a scholarship to go there. Otherwise, I never could have gone. I went for the interview for this thing in London, and I remember the first thing that they asked me when I got into the room was, please describe this room in Italian. Well, I had a few words of Italian, so I had a good try, but I got the thing and went to study with Petrassi in Rome, and that was wonderful.
Had you at that time had any professional performances of your compositions?
Very few, probably two or three, that's all, particularly at the Dartington Summer School.
Continental countries, on the whole, are kinder to young composers than ours, I am told. Did you get some performances in Italy or roundabout?
Yes, I did. I got a prize for an orchestral piece in Italy, and it was played there, and it was a very valuable experience to have an orchestral piece played at that very early stage. You learn so much from having even a bad orchestral piece played. That I don't think was a particularly good one. But it was quite wonderful to hear one's own work played by an orchestra, and also rather humiliating because you realise how much better other people have done it.
How long were you in Italy?
I was there for a year.
And you came back to England. This, I believe, was 1958. You taught in a school for a while.
Yes, I taught at Cirencester Grammar School in Gloucestershire. I don't think I was a particularly good teacher or anything, but I did find that when the kids were writing their music, this was, for me, very liberating, because kids can write music if you just let them, just as they can paint and make poetry and things. And those kids were producing music which was a great deal less inhibited than what I was doing. And that sheer joy and the sheer freedom of it, I think, taught me a lot.
Yes.
And I probably learnt far more teaching at Cirencester than I ever taught.
You mounted an ambitious production of the Monteverdi Vespers.
Oh, yes, that involved hundreds of kids. And I did an arrangement of whole chunks of it, specially for as many people as possible. I like to, when I'm working with kids, involve as many as possible, even if they're just playing open strings or something.
Mm.
So long as the strings are in tune and it fits the harmony and they play it in time, fine. Very unauthentic version, I'm sure. But again, it was a very good way of getting to know that piece, the Monteverdi Vespers.
And then a fellowship at Princeton. How did that come about?
I met Aaron Copland. He's the senior American composer now, I think, at the Dartington Summer School. And I got to know him quite well, and he liked my work. And he said, hey, Max, why don't you go to America? There's a very good teacher at Princeton called Roger Sessions.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, however would I get there? And he said, well, there's this great scholarship going, and I'll give you a reference, and Ben Britton will give you one, and you'll be fine. And I got it.
Was that rewarding?
Oh, it was marvellous. I had time to write full-time, which, after Cirencester, I really needed. And Princeton University itself had such a stimulating atmosphere. The students there and the people who were lecturing, they were so inquisitive about new music. And even people like, I remember Professor Strunk doing Byzantine music, early medieval stuff. I got so much out of those things. And even things like the philosophy course and fine art courses, you could just drop in on those things. And it was a very stimulating time indeed.
At the end of that 2 years, wasn't it?
Yes.
Did you feel then that your academic activities as pupil and teacher were at an end? You were now to be a composer. Was there any kind of a breakthrough feeling?
Yes, there was. I came back and signed a contract with the publishers, Boosey and Hawkes, which gave me a retainer, which was just about enough to live on if I got a few royalties from the odd performance. And so I could now be a full-time composer and not have that financial worry.
Right, that's a watershed. So let's have record number four.
Well, I've chosen a piece of American music by Elliot Carter, his concerto for orchestra. I find Carter's music very stimulating, and for me, it in some way sums up the whole experience of coming to terms with particularly New York, which I find a very difficult place indeed, and the whole American experience that I've had over the years.
Elliot Carter's Concerto for Orchestra, played by the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. Did you know Elliot Carter? Or do you know Elliot Carter?
Oh, yes, he was another composer who had an enormous influence on me. I met him at the Dartington Summer School. Mm-hmm. So many people I've met there.
Right, so you were working in London as a full-time professional composer. Now, you formed a group. It was the age of groups. Everybody had a group. Tell me about yours.
Well, it was really Birtwistle's idea in the first place. Harrison Birtwistle, my fellow composer. And we decided that we weren't getting enough performances of our work, and those that we did get, many of them were not all that good, because players were being reluctant, and sometimes conductors were also being reluctant or hadn't studied the score enough. You know how it is with young composers. People don't take you terribly seriously. And so we formed our own group called the Piero Players, now the Fires of London. And this, I think, has been an enormous help to me, to have a group like that,
yes,
of players that you can trust. You know they're going to really work very, very hard to prepare a piece properly, and you'll get a first-class performance, and many of them too.
How many regular members?
We're basically 8 people, and we can add to that as we need to.
And a rather theatrical bias to the group.
Very much so, yes. I'm very interested in opera and music theatre, and I've written quite a number of pieces for the group which involve mime or dancing or some kind of theatrical element. You can put across all sorts of strange points of view in a very direct and minimal way, which really grabs people,
yes,
when you do this. And it's as if the so-called problems of contemporary music just disappear if you get their attention like that.
And, of course, The Fires of London is a good dramatic title, an inspired title.
Yes, it is.
Now, you were working hard, you were very productive, much in the public eye. Then, in 1970, you decided to go to live on the island of Hoy in the Orkneys. Beautiful, I'm told, but about as isolated as you can get. Was retirement to work in a concentrated way your only reason?
It's hard to say, it really is. You know, it just seemed to happen, and it was right.
What's the population of Hoy?
Oh, I don't really know. It must be about 200 down the other end in Long Hope and Lyness, where I am. Very few indeed. 2 families, basically.
And when you went there, there was no electricity?
Oh, no. No luxuries like that.
In fact, until recently, I believe the only records you played were the good old-fashioned 78s that you had to wind up the gramophone.
That's right. I've still got this marvellous English handmade gramophone, garden party size, which it had to go in the house before the roof went on because it's so enormous and the door would be too narrow. And, of course, the house had no roof when I took it over. This had to be put on.
Mm.
And first thing that went in, even before the roof, was this 78 RPM gramophone.
How much has Hoy influenced your music?
Oh, a lot. Not only in that I've been able to concentrate and work many, many hours for a long time together, many, many weeks together, but just the experience of having your ears cleaned out so that you can hear natural sounds, sounds of the wind, sounds of the waves, without machine noises, without electric humming or anything, which really, in a city, it's always there, even if you don't notice it. And traffic noise, of course, there's no road anywhere near. So just this encounter with natural sound, I think, was a revelation at that stage for me. And I was very concerned with not reproducing these sounds in my own work, but somehow conveying to the listener something of this joy and the sheer newness of being able to hear those tiny natural sounds. And, of course, they do get into the music, but they're transformed into musical terms rather than being raw natural sounds.
How much of the year are you there?
Present 2 years, I'm there very little, what with the opera and at Covent Garden and a great deal of travel. But for the past few years, I've been there 8 or 9 months a year.
You run an annual Orkneys festival on the main island. What's that called?
That's the St. Magnus Festival,
yes,
in June, midsummer. And that I decided to do really just to say thank you to the islands, because I've got so much out of them. It's nice to be able to put something in.
And you get a lot of visitors?
We get a lot of visitors, but basically that festival is for the local people. And we try to give as big a variety of fair drama, concerts, theatre, poetry reading, folk music, as we can. And, of course, I feel that I must contribute by writing pieces, particularly for the schools there, which the children can perform, the cathedral choir sometimes, and sometimes for visiting orchestras or whatever, so that I'm making a very firm contribution myself. I feel I must do this.
We've got to record number 5.
An old favourite, Bartok's 5th String Quartet, one of those pieces where, as a boy, I realised that music isn't only in 3-4 and 4-4, that it can be at 7-8 and 9-8 and change all the time.
An excerpt from Bartok's String Quartet No. 5, played by the Hungarian String Quartet. Max, early on you became fascinated by medieval and Renaissance music.
Yes, I did. This was not only because the professor of music at Manchester University advised his students, me in particular, to take no notice of music after 1900, except Delius, no notice of music before 1500, because it's dangerous. and, of course, that which is, as it were, forbidden is always very attractive. But I was really drawn to the sound and feel of medieval music right from first days at university.
And that led to an interest in a Tudor musician named Taverner.
Yes, it did, about whom or upon whom I pegged an opera, if you like, an opera which takes place in his own mind, and I've used him as, well, really a peg upon which to hang some of my own preoccupations, I suppose, because I've made the whole opera happen really inside John Taverner's head, and he gives up his music when he becomes a Protestant and an agent of Thomas Cromwell, and he, in the early part of the 16th century, was had up for heresy and nearly burnt at the stake, it seems, but let off because he was a musician. And after that, he might have, and in my work he does, become rather vindictive about persecuting people who will not accept the new faith. I wanted to make a work which exposed this whole problem of betraying that which really makes you tick, that which, even if you don't think you do, you really do believe in the essential you for a political or a religious reason after a conversion.
Taverner, of course, is in the repertoire at the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden. In fact, it's currently being revived for the second time, isn't it?
It's the second revival, yes.
That's your only full-scale opera, but there have been a number of chamber operas and masques and so on.
Yes, there have. I find that if you write a smaller one, of not such a big force, you get many more performances. And the Martyrdom of St. Magnus, which I first wrote for the Orkney Festival, and The Lighthouse, particularly, which I wrote for the Edinburgh Festival, must be, what, 3 years ago now, they're getting an awful lot of performances, not so much in Britain, but around Europe and America. And
so children's operas, as you said, you like working with children.
Yes, that's a very fruitful field, and I thoroughly enjoy that.
You had a big success in Copenhagen with a ballet, Salome. Is that going to be done here?
I doubt whether it will be done here. It probably will get performances in, well, it's being performed now in America, and in Germany rather than here. But these things are very, very slow to take off in Britain.
Having a nude Salome did no harm to the business in Copenhagen, I gather.
Sure it didn't.
And a couple of film scores.
Yes, I did a couple of film scores for Ken Russell.
One of them based on the Boyfriend tunes from Sandy Wilson.
Yes, we're doing that at the Proms quite soon.
Ken Russell, a colourful man, not always a very easy man to work with, I believe.
Sometimes not. I remember on the Boyfriend, he said, oh, yes, I promise you that we won't record this bit until you've finished the score, which I was going to have ready in a couple of days. I thought he was going to record it just with piano and then expect me to dub the music on the top of it, and he promised me he wouldn't. And then he actually did it. And so I had to record this music over a whole day, listening to a tape of this wretched thing going all over the place, extraordinary rubatos, in C major, and my arrangement was in C sharp. So I had a band playing in C sharp, and the cans on my head were in C. I don't think I've ever had a worse headache in my life, and did I curse him out.
We've got to record number six.
This is opera, Monteverdi, The Coronation of Poppea. This intrigues me, this work, because throughout the opera, Nero behaves disgracefully, murdering this and that one, and at the end there's a complete triumph of evil, and Poppea and Nero sing this love duet very innocently right at the end, and it is so beautiful and so touching, and one knows that they're wholly evil. It makes me think.
The closing duet from Monteverdi's The Coronation of Poppea and the singers Helen Donat and Elizabeth Soderstrom. Now, your concert music, Max, you've written two symphonies, is that right?
Yes, two to date.
And you're working on a third?
Not yet. At the moment, I'm doing a sequence of, well, three at least, I don't know whether there are going to be more, quite large chamber orchestral pieces. Present one for the Scottish Chamber Orchestra for Edinburgh University's 400th anniversary. Mm. These are smaller symphonic works. Before I tackle another big one, I want to have worked out one or two things on a smaller scale.
Your list of published works of one sort or another stands at well over 100. You're very prolific, aren't you?
I suppose so, yes. I do spend most of my time actually writing music. Mm. My waking hours and probably my sleeping hours too, without thinking about it.
And apart from the creative writing, I suppose every composer has a certain amount of routine work to do, like arranging, rearranging or reductions of published works. Do you find that a chore?
Yes, I do. I usually do that more or less automatically, but it's a good opportunity for listening to music. Of course, you tend to do it more slowly and you tend to make more mistakes when you're listening to music, when you're doing some purely routine thing like reducing or copying. But otherwise, it gets very tedious.
You mentioned Dartington. You also find time to be musical director there. How long in the year does that take?
The summer school at Dartington only takes 1 month of the year. Of course, there's a lot of other time thinking about it and meetings of one kind or another, planning. But I think that's a very worthwhile thing. When I was a student, Dartington certainly did a lot for me, and I'd like to do something for it.
And a very pleasant place to be.
Lovely place, yes.
Record number seven.
The Symphony number seven by Sibelius. I remember hearing this in, I think it was a whole cycle of the symphonies of Sibelius that Barbarolli did with the Halle when I was a boy in Manchester. And I remember hearing this trombone tune in the Seventh Symphony, and I think my hair must have stood on end. It struck me as one of the most, well, ominous sounds I'd ever heard, but so invigorating and so enormously atmospheric, like black clouds and thunder. Tremendous piece, and I've never forgotten the first time I ever heard it in Manchester.
Thank you.
an excerpt from the 7th Sibelius Symphony, Sir John Barbirolli conducting the Halle Orchestra. Now, with your experience of living on an island, a fairly remote island, I should surmise that you're pretty good at survival. Could you run up a hut to live in?
I suppose I could, yes.
What about fishing?
At home, I'm quite content to eat fish that my neighbour brings occasionally, or he calls up when he's bringing the boat in and I go down and help him out with his boat and he gives me fish. But I don't think, under normal circumstances, I would have the patience to sit there with a line or go out in a boat and do it. I prefer to be writing music, but needs be, of course, one would.
Are you a good cook?
I think so.
Do you enjoy it?
I love cooking.
You do a lot of it?
I do. I think it's quite an important part of my life, in fact. I know that on Hoi sometimes, well, most days when I've done perhaps a 12-hour stint of work, more or less uninterrupted, unless I've done a bit of gardening or gone for a short walk, that I will, even if it's midnight, cook a meal, set out the table properly for myself with the right cutlery, the right glass for the right kind of half bottle of wine, and have my meal in candlelit style, all by myself. And this, I think, is very important.
Splendid. We'll allow you to take a dinner jacket to your desert island. Do you enjoy sailing?
I have never sailed as such, but I'm not seasick. I've never been seasick.
Yes.
Except once on a dreadful boat called the St. Clement, going from the north of Scotland to Orkney. And I think the weather must have been the worst it has ever been, and I felt slightly queasy. But normally I'm not seasick at all, and I very much enjoy the sea.
If you could construct some kind of a craft, would you try to escape?
You know, I'd have to think about that one.
Do you know anything about navigation? Do you know which is south and which is north?
I probably know that, yes.
Well, that's a help.
That is certainly a help. But I don't know whether I would even want to escape if I had a supply of music paper and pencils.
Right. We're coming to your luxury in a minute. Let's have your last record.
The Bird four-part mass, the Agnus Dei, particularly the last bit, I find very moving, the Dona Nobis Pacem, give us peace.
An excerpt from the William Byrd four-part mass, the choir of Christ Church Cathedral, Oxford, conducted by Simon Preston. If you could take only one disc of the Age of Plato's?
Probably the William Byrd.
The last one?
Yes.
The mass. And one luxury. Well, you mentioned a supply of manuscript paper and pencils.
Yes, this is a hard one. You know, one thing which I think would probably be very useful would be a few loo rolls, to be quite practical.
Yes.
On the other hand, I would be very tempted to have a good supply of claret, or perhaps unusual Italian wines or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I think music paper would be it, so long as I had pencils.
All right. And one book, apart from the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, already there?
This is a difficult one. Again, very tempted to take something very serious, like the Summa of Thomas Aquinas, or perhaps the Divine Comedy of Dante. But then I thought that it might be better to have something funny. It would help no end. And I thought, well, Rabelais. But then I thought, you know that perhaps rather well. So why don't you take one that you don't know all that well? I've read it about 8 times, I think. But it really is one of the funniest books and the most thought-provoking books in creation, I should think. And that's the Ulysses of James Joyce.
And it's a good long one, too.
It's very long.
Ulysses by James Joyce. And thank you, Peter Maxwell Davis, for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
Goodbye, everyone.
Desert Island Discs was introduced and devised by Roy Plumley. The producer was Derek Drescher. You may like to know that Taverner, the opera which Peter Maxwell Davis talked about, is being broadcast by Radio 3, direct from the Royal Opera House at 7:30 next Wednesday evening, the 6th of July. In fact, July seems to be Peter Maxwell Davis month on Radio 3, as on three Thursdays, Music in Our Time will be devoted to his music. Next Friday, the Castaway and Desert Island Discs will be one of the Monty Python team, Terry Jones.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.